How we doing, everybody? Thanks for tuning into the AthoraCast, the podcast that is all things Georgia World Congress Center Authority. We've got a cool episode for you today as we dive into a new film that has roots with GWCCA and Centennial Olympic Park, and that is The Games in Black and White by the Atlanta Story Partners. The film is centered around the unlikely partnership behind Atlanta's Olympic dream, and that partnership would be the inspirational friendship of icons Andrew Young and Billy Payne. What the writers describe as the most successful black and white partnership in the American South in the civil rights era. The film presents the first comprehensive look at Atlanta's Olympics from bid to legacy and the city's transformation that followed. And the film is set to premiere April 26th at the Rialto Center for the Arts. Of course, the Georgia World Congress Center Authority campus played a huge role in the 1996 Games, with sporting events held at GWCC and the Georgia Dome, and of course, the world's gathering place of Centennial Olympic Park. I was lucky enough to sit down with co-founder and writer-producer with the Atlanta Story Partners, George Herthler, and Alana Lark, who's a producer on the film, to dive into the story, what folks can expect from this film, and how Centennial Olympic Park made the perfect anchor for telling the story of the 1996 Olympic Games. So first off, thank you, George and Alana, for joining me today to talk a little bit about The Games in Black and White, a film that I'm guessing y'all been working on for a little while, you know.
Our pleasure.
Of course. You know, it's coming up on 30 years since the Games here in Olympic, since the Olympic Games here in Atlanta. I can't talk. I'm getting tongue-tied. But just kind of first off looking at it, what's one of the things you kind of hope that people take away from this film after the premiere on April 26th?
Well, we set the story of the Olympic Games against the backdrop of Atlanta's vibrant civil rights movement, history, and heritage. And because Andy Young and Billy Payne teamed up to do this, we saw, looking back, in many ways, that their quest fulfilled the promise of the civil rights movement. And so we want people to understand that without the civil rights movement, we could have never won the Olympic Games. And it wasn't just because Andy Young was in there. It was because Atlanta represented something very profound around the world. And when this team, a black man and a white man, went out together to share their story and in some ways exhibit their friendship to the world, it compelled a lot of people to bring it here. And we want the audience today, you know, there are many people, like you said, it's 30 years since the Games have been here. And the younger generation knows very little about this. I think when Alana and I first met over at Georgia State University, and we started talking about doing this film with Bob Judson, who was her professor and considered her one of the best young filmmakers in Atlanta. She'd already graduated. I remember that we talked about the history of the Atlanta Games, and it wasn't like immediately all familiar to you. You didn't really know that story.
Yeah, I'm actually 30 years old, so I was, what, two when they happened? But, you know, the truth of the matter is everyone has an Olympic story, you know, a 96 Atlanta Olympic story. Whether you were there or not, you have a story relating to it because it was just so pivotal to the fabric of who we are as Atlantans. And I think when you asked, what do we want people to get from this film, you know, this film is a labor of love for our city. And, you know, the 96 Atlanta Olympics had its controversies. And I think oftentimes we put such a lens to that instead of the contributions that make us amazing. And so what we really wanted to say is Atlanta influences everything, first of all. Second of all, how do we give a gift to our people to say, you know, we made something amazing happen that everyone in the world was doubting us, and to say, look at the legacy it left.
I mean, if you look back at the history of Atlanta, you know, all the way back to the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement, and you could look at what happened through the partnership of Billy Payne and Andy Young and what they did to transform this city and to draw this city together, which is why Andy was motivated to do this. He thought it would bring our city together across all the neighborhood lines that divide us. And if you look at what they did, in some ways, it was Atlanta's finest hour. Mm. It was really a great moment. When we started bidding for the games in 1989 and I traveled to Europe, part of the bid team, you had to draw on a napkin a map to show where Florida was and where Disney World was to show people where Atlanta was. Nobody in the world knew where Atlanta was.
Wow.
And now you can't go anywhere in the world that isn't familiar with the location of Atlanta and Southeast, the South capital of the Southeastern United States. So it was really an amazing transformation. That's all down to the work these guys did to put us on the global map.
Yeah.
And I like that you mentioned that, too, because I've been places and people say, where are you from? I say, the States. They say, where? And they'd say, you know, New Orleans. And they would say, oh, I don't know. Is that Los Angeles, New York? Is that close to there? And I say, no, Atlanta. And they say, oh, okay, yeah, it's kind of, it's not very close, but, you know, when you're halfway across the world, I guess it's a little bit close. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, with all this in the works and everything, was there a point to where I'm sure that this has been an idea for a while, but you kind of said, oh, this is happening. We're putting this film together and we're going to put this out. Was there kind of, you know what I mean? Kind of that moment where it clicked and you said, this is real. We're putting this together.
If I may begin, Bob Judson and I met in August or September of 2019 for a drink. And we hadn't seen each other in 10 years, but we went back. We had a friendship that went back 30 years in film production and we'd worked together on the Atlanta Olympics. And, I was trying to brush up on some production ideas, and I asked him if he would meet. And when we finished the conversation, he said, what can we do together? And I said, you know, instantly, no one's really done a good documentary on the Atlanta Olympic Games. The bid, the games, and the legacy. It's a good three-part story. He said, I'm all in. What do we, you know? He said, why don't you write something up and we'll take it from there. Next day, I started writing and realized the story we wanted to tell immediately was the story of Billy and Andy. Because at the time, in 2019, race relations are bad today, but the state of race relations in our society was such that if you have a positive story to tell, you got to get it out there. Mm-hmm. You got to give it to people so that they understand that when blacks and whites work together, what they can accomplish is incredible. And at that moment, we were both really motivated. And then we wrote a little story and we started sharing that story. Alana was one of the first people to see it. She reacted and said, this is a beautiful story and I want to be part of it. But I think the day that I called Billy and Andy and said, we want to do this, went to see them both. And they both said, okay, whatever you need. That was the day we knew the train was going to roll down the track. You remember that first meeting at Georgia State?
Yeah, of course. I remember it well. I mean, you know, in this industry, sometimes people have great ideas. And they don't always have the wherewithal to follow through. Bob Judson has been my mentor since I was in college at Georgia State. And whenever he presented something to me, I knew it was a sure thing because he is not one of those people. You know, if he says he wants to do something, he's going to make it happen, whether he has to wear three hats or, you know, can pass it on to other mentees to have an opportunity. So, I had no doubts that it was going to happen. And then meeting George, every time George speaks about the Olympics, something lights up in him. It's been such a central aspect of his career and his life. And I think in them bringing me on, there was a desire to have diversity both behind the scenes as well as in front of the camera, right? So if you were talking about black and white man coming together to make a film, you know, and then you have these two white guys, George and Bob, they're like, well,
two maybe, old white guys.
Maybe we need a young black woman to help us tell this story and so that we can prioritize diversity as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Very cool. And was there anything while you were putting this together that maybe you had forgotten about from the Olympics or something that you uncovered that you said, whoa, you know, I didn't know that, or really anything you learned along the way?
Yeah, there were a number of things that that really the research began to illuminate memories that had been forgotten, that I had forgotten. I knew the outline by heart. I mean, I was hired to write Atlanta's Olympic bid as the lead writer on the Atlanta Olympic bid campaign in January of 1989 and sent to Luzon in April of 1989. So I was part of a creative team with Brad Copeland. We were the lead creative team for the bid. And then we became the lead, one of the lead design firms of the look of the game. So I went all the way through it with Billy and Andy from the bid, from the early days of the bid all the way through the game. So I knew the story because I had participated in it, worked on it. And then I got hired by other cities to go help them with their bids. And we'll come back to that later. But when we started to do the investigation, there were two stories that I knew we wanted to tell. That are a big part of what's been forgotten about the Atlanta Olympic effort here. The first one was the Equal Economic Opportunity Program that Billy and Andy and Maynard agreed to implement for the Games. And in the end, over a six-year period, they managed to engage 4,000 minority and female-owned businesses in the Olympics so that it lifted the lifestyle, lifted the businesses, lifted the community in a great way. And then the second one was Olympic Aid, which was the story of Andy Young deciding that the game should be a force for peace around the world, teaming up with Johan Olof Koss, and that's in the film. And both those things we can talk about in more detail. But the Atlanta Olympic Games actually was, through UNICEF, responsible for striking peace agreements in 14 countries with conflict zones and immunizing almost 15 million children in the run-up and through the games. Those were extraordinary stories that really illuminated the humanitarian outreach of the games. And what about you? What did you pick up from all of that?
All of it. First of all, like I said, I'm 30 years old. I was 2 when the Olympics came to the city. And so oftentimes when I select a film to produce, I pick something about Atlanta that I don't know about, but I know is influential. So my first film was Sweet Auburn Blues, my first film was 100 Years at the Rialto. So it was about 100 years of history at the Rialto Theater, which is ironically where Games in Black and White will be premiering. So full circle moment for me there. And then my second one was about Auburn Avenue and all of the history of the civil rights movement and all the influential leaders of the civil rights movement who did so much of their planning on that street. And so when it comes to this story, it was okay to me that I was not the historical expert on the subject matter, because something beautiful about filmmaking is you can learn as you go. You can learn through conversations with people who are the experts. You know, George himself is an expert. So as a producer, my job is to bring together the best talent. So I'm very connected with the Atlanta talent when it comes to crews. I know how to lock down a location. So my job is great when I can employ extremely talented and passionate individuals. The rest I leave to our writer, our expert.
Alana brought incredible crews to the table for all of our shoots, and we relied on her. She was lead producer on the film, and so every time we would often rent Airbnb or Pier Space homes to conduct the shoots, because we wanted to put people in a kind of a homey environment in a regular daily setting, and then hear their memories on camera. And she'd bring together these great crews, and we often used some of the same people, but not all the same people. We shot 40 interviews, and we shot them all over the city. And then we did go to Paris, and we went to Oslo to capture Johan Olof Koss's memories of working with Andy Young. And we went to L.A. to get Casey Wasserman, Janet Evans, and Doug Arnott, all of whom had they're all involved in L.A. 2028 and had a very cool perspective on the Atlanta Games. Janet was the one who carried the torch up to light Muhammad Ali's torch.
Very cool.
Doug Arnott was in charge of all the venue operations, so he remembered the bombing very well and told a beautiful story about how we recovered from that. But anyway, it was really a remarkable effort, remarkable undertaking, and I think the city is going to find it to be a very inspiring film.
Absolutely. No question.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, I'm kind of in the same boat that you are. I think I was 8 when the Olympics were here. So, you know, I have those memories of...
A little short thing of,
you know, Kurt Angle winning a gold medal and building B right there. But, you know, also the gymnast and the vault for gold, things like that. But I feel like I'm going to be surprised by a lot. But are there any things that you can think of that might not give too much away that, you know, you think folks might be surprised about? Or is it just all kind of bringing back those memories that people may have kind of, they've faded a little bit?
Well, what... It's harder for me to think about what may be surprising. I think Alana may have a better perspective on that. I do have one thing, but I'll come back to it after she responds.
Yeah, I mean, the Equal Economic Opportunity Program was by far my favorite aspect of this story to cover, simply because when it comes to Atlanta history, you know, Black excellence has to be highlighted. And so when you think about people like David Moody, whose construction company was so pivotal in building the Olympic Stadium, or Cynthia Jones Parks, whose consultation firm was really influential in the EEOP, it's just great to give people like that their flowers who everyday Atlantans don't know who they are. But now I know who they are and how influential they were in making our city what it is today. So, you know, I'm an Atlanta girl. Like, my grandparents met at HBCUs in the city, and as a product of a Black Love Atlanta story, I really light up when it comes to telling those stories of Black excellence. So I really appreciated being able to highlight those people and that program specifically.
I think one of the other things that is phenomenal that came out in the film is the fact that when Billy and Andy led the city's quest for, I think it was almost 4 years for Billy and almost as long for Andy, and when they got to the moment when we were giving our final presentations in Tokyo, both of them had a breakdown, a personal breakdown. Mm-hmm. When they realized the next day this quest is going to be over and 350 people have followed us all the way here to Tokyo and the entire city is waiting to hear this judgment, the emotional impact of those moments hit both of them separately. They both broke down crying, I mean, just sobbing, and then were brought together and found out that each had had the same experience, and they were isolated in a hotel room. And as Billy said, Andy walked me off the cliff. What he meant was, of course, that Andy walked him back from the cliff, but it works perfectly within the film to hear him say that.
And it's kind of a funny moment.
And then I'm really excited that this film will reveal the extent of the legacy of the games to the people of Atlanta, many of whom don't understand exactly what Centennial Olympic Park really has done for this city, and that's only one measure. That's only one dimension of it. But we really do take the time at the end to celebrate the games to the point where I state the same thing a couple of times over and over again. Part of that is deliberate, because for 20 years I've listened to people say that the Atlanta Olympic Games have not left much of a legacy. So we're going to drill it into them that, yeah, it did leave a legacy, and here's a point, and here's a point, and here's a point. And it's a pretty illuminating part of the film.
Yeah, and I'll add to that, you know, we did also address the controversy. You know, we're journalists as well, so the truth is important, and at no point did we have a desire to not acknowledge some of the negative feedback that was given to the games. But, you know, at a certain point, it's like, okay, we get it. And how do we also celebrate the wins that the Olympics gave to the city? So I think we did a really excellent job. I'll toot our own horns in terms of creating balance around there's good and bad in everything, right? But to only acknowledge the bad is a disservice to all of these people who work so hard to bring something so big to our city.
And I'm going to give full credit to Alana here, because I'm a really, I've got a positive focus on this story. I would have told it beginning to end without a negative note. Alana wouldn't let me do that. She said, she came to me and she said, you know, we really got to bring in a couple of voices that are going to address the homeless problem and some of the other problems that that the games, you know, had an impact on or negatively triggered. I did stay away from the negatives, the most of the negative criticisms of the games operationally, the transportation issues, the technology issues. I brushed over those quickly, but we brought Alana Found and we brought in a few guests and had them talk about what they considered the dark side or the negative side of the impact of the games. And then and that's given the film I think some credibility and balance that wouldn't have been in there if it hadn't been for her advocacy. And she wouldn't let me go on it, so she came back at me a couple times before I finally relented. And
I think
Jabari
came in with like a 10-page report. Yeah. I was like,
she did.
Read this.
Yeah. Now the truth is there are people out there who will argue against all that too. We didn't want to open the film up to a debate, you know, a negative positive debate. But we did find advocates on both sides. I think Jabari Samama was really good on it, really quite balanced and on it, and he was a vital interview.
Yeah, he was a city council member at the time, so mm-hmm. he, you know, really understood politically the impacts that the games were having, so he could speak from that perspective regarding the displacement of some Atlantans. And I think what he did well was he wasn't putting blame on any one entity. But he acknowledged that it is something that happened, whether directly or indirectly. Watch the film to find out his opinion.
And you mentioned kind of the lasting impression or things that the games accomplished here. And, of course, you mentioned Centennial Olympic Park and, you know, working for Georgia World Congress Center Authority. Of course, I'm going to, you know, dive into that.
Yeah, you
used
should.
The park as kind of the narrative hub or home, I guess, for the
yes.
film. I mean, why
yeah.
was that important to do that for y'all?
Well, you know, Georgia World Congress Center was a major part of the Olympic bid's technical strength. I mean, we had 11 sports here. Nick, you can correct me if I've got the numbers wrong, but I think we had 11 sports set here, and I remember coming to the heavyweight Greco-Roman wrestling final with Alexander Carolin, who's in our film, and it was amazing. I brought my uncle. I remember being here for team handball, for a couple of team handball matches. I'd never seen team handball live, a really exciting sport. But of course, the development of Centennial Olympic Park not only changed our games and made our games far better despite the bombing, but it also changed the future of the city. It's like an economic engine that just won't quit. It's still transforming downtown Atlanta. And so when I first drafted the script and we talked conceptually about it to begin with, we came up with the idea that we wanted an on-camera narrator. And we thought, okay, we want an African-American on-camera narrator who's got a contemporary view of things. And, you know, we thought Samuel Jackson, right? Morehouse graduate.
Yeah.
So I got a hold of his agent, sent him some materials, never heard back. When we were looking for someone to record the narration, and we decided with an on-camera narrator, we could visit with this narrator in a setting 6-7 times during the film so that the viewer could be brought back to the base, transitions could be made, we could move to new sections of the storytelling, and across the three acts, across the three major chapters, if you will. And so when we were looking for a narrator, and we went to Smart Post in Atlanta, one of the major recording studios, and they said, have you heard of Greg Allen Williams? And Greg Allen Williams is a fantastic actor. In the famous Denzel Washington movie, Remember the Titans, he plays the offensive line coach and sits Denzel down and gives him a great on-camera lecture. We met Greg. His voice, his delivery, his style, his personality, his presence, the guy is just an absolute master. And he delivered an incredible narration, and we said to him, Greg, would you be interested in maybe performing on camera and being a host for us. I bought him a pork pie hat the night before he came in for a brief audition. He put that thing on, and man, we got to the park for our big shot. We decided, okay, where are we going to have this narrator? And we decided, narrator, every time you see him, he should be in a different part of the park. Because we wanted to root the film just as the games were rooted here in the park and the Georgia World Congress Center, what was the Omni then, and of course the Georgia Dome. We wanted to bring people back to that center point, and so we do that again and again. And Alana produced the big shoot in the park. I think we had a crew of 35 people, didn't we? And we had how many setups do we have? About seven.
Yeah. So Asante White actually did most of the producing for that.
The line, he was a line producer, yeah.
Yeah. But it was an amazing, amazing shoot. The weather was perfect, you know, other than a few helicopters messing up our audio, you know, those are variables that just are part of filming out in the field. You know, It's not a controlled environment like we tend to like. But, you know, like you were saying, George, this Centennial Olympic Park was an anchor, a narrative anchor for this film. And as Greg Allen Williams is walking through the park, you know, he's also walking you through the story. And it made sense for this to be the anchor of the film because it was an anchor of the games. And for me, as an Atlantan, I hadn't really been to Centennial Olympic Park before the shoot. Can you believe that?
Wow.
I had been to the Center for Civil and Human Rights Museum.
Well, right on the park.
I had been to the Georgia Aquarium. And so actually being in the park for that shoot that day, I thought, you know, Centennial Olympic Park is the reason that the Georgia Aquarium is right there. It's the reason that the Center for Civil and Human Rights Museum is right there. It's such a central aspect of our city. And so, you know, Greg Allen Williams and, you know, props to George Hertler's writing on this. He utilizes this space with his stand-ups to, you know, draw back on the history, take you back to the games. And then also bring you to the present, to what this park exhibits for Atlanta and the surrounding area of, you know, all of these tourist attractions that make our city one of the best places to visit.
Beautiful. And George, I don't mean to catch you super off guard. I forgot to mention this beforehand. Nick mentioned maybe possibly a story about it, the handoff from Barcelona to Atlanta. You know, it kind of having someone had a little bit of a moment that may have birthed the park of having kind of a meeting place for the games.
Yeah, when Billy and the delegation traveled to Barcelona, where What Is It was introduced in the closing ceremonies, we got 5 minutes to perform in the closing ceremonies, as every future host city does. It's part of the Olympic ritual. When we walked around Barcelona, it was obvious that what the city had were a lot of urban spaces that were very inviting to big crowds. And the Ramblas was one of those in the heart of the city, a diagonal road that went on for miles, that every night was crowded with people. The National Palace sat at the top of a boulevard with great walking corridors along it, with a series of fountains leading up to it, with a big Capitol dome on the top of it. And at night, those fountains would shoot up and they'd play incredible music. And it was really, and Billy came home thinking, we need a gathering place. And because he was in the Inforum, and his balcony overlooked a derelict area that separated the Georgia World Congress Center from the downtown corridor, Billy, being the visionary that he is, he immediately came up with the idea that's where we ought to have our meeting place. And as a result, we ended up with, a stroke of brilliance on his part, we ended up with 21-acre park in the middle of the city that linked everything together that had been separated by this canyon of old dilapidated buildings and warehouses that people did not want to kind of walk through at night with broken streetlights. And, you know, it was not a pretty place. And so he led the transformation. It was all done privately. You know, Home Depot sold bricks. The park was built for $70 million, and Home Depot sold $45 million worth of bricks to individuals.
Everyone remembers those bricks.
Yeah,
the
bricks.
That was genius marketing.
Yeah, it was really brilliant. And so he came home, and, you know, he knew that he wanted to find a place. We only had 2 years to go, or 3 years. Well, that was 1992, and I guess he came up with the idea later that year. But, you know, it had to be built in like 17 months, I think. And it was done, and it was a great experience. But getting back to the park and the way it works in our film, we open the story in the park and we close the story in the park. And not just metaphorically, but literally. When Greg Allen Williams first appears on camera, you're behind him and he's walking toward the gates of the park, and the gates swing open as he enters. And when he finishes his story, as Alana said, he tells you, walks you through this whole story. When he finishes his seventh cut or sixth cut, whatever it was, he then comes out of the park and the gates close behind him. Hmm. So Centennial Olympic Park is central to our storytelling.
And was it fun to shoot in there? Because, I mean, I see it just about every day whenever I go for walks or anything like that. So, of course, I'm a little biased. You know, it's a beautiful place right downtown. But, I mean, was it nice to be able to shoot there and just kind of have that scenery behind y'all?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It was a beautiful day, like I said. I was mainly working with Greg Allen Williams that day. And, you know, for him, we needed to have extra shirts, and we did not think about that because it did get a little hot. You know, you're standing
up. It can get
up,
warm out there, yeah.
You're talking to the camera. So after every take, he would change shirts, and I would just hang it up. At one point, we worried about it getting wrinkled, so I just ran over to a hotel nearby, and I was like, hey, you guys got an iron we can just borrow real quick. And Atlanta being the community that it is, and us being in such a central location, that there's hotels everywhere. There's so many establishments right by the park. So they were like, this is a weird request, but sure. So ironed out his shirt, brought it back. I mean, it was the perfect location.
And being able to tell this story, you know, something that I guess kind of the nexus is in 1996 or whatever, but it's still very relevant to today. Is there a little bit of pride in being able to walk through? I mean, how long of a span does the film cover? But to walk through the decade or however long the film is?
Beginning to end, it starts in with Billy and, well, tells it does give a bio of Billy and Andy, so it goes back to their childhoods. But really, the story starts in 1987 in a church when Billy comes up with this idea, having just accomplished the development of a new cathedral, leading the effort to build a new cathedral for his church. So it goes from 1987 right up till today, because the legacy is still unfolding, and when those gates close, you're seeing gates that'll be open tomorrow morning. And so it spans that entire era, that entire era of time. Shooting in the park was magnificent. We had a crew of 35. It was the largest shoot we had, and it took 2 days. Thank you, Centennial Olympic Park, Georgia World Congress Center, for giving us the park gratis, didn't charge us for anything, and providing security as well.
Yeah.
We tried to highlight the major aspects of the park. So we had Greg Allen Williams in the Fountain of the Rings. Mm. We showed the plaques on the wall that represent the history of the Olympic bid and the effort, all of which I was happy to show because that's my writing. In those plates. And then we showed the Coubertin statue. And he talked about this film really is about, in some ways, the intersection of the civil rights movement and the Olympic movement and the values they share. And so we tied that all together. Greg Allen was able to tie that together beautifully in a stand-up around the Coubertin statue, celebrating the history of the Olympic movement, which has always been open to everybody and has a special place in the hearts of African Americans. Historically, before other sports were open to them, the Olympic movement was, and we established those facts. And then we took them over and set them by the fountain. We had him standing beneath the Inforum so he could talk about how Billy came up with the idea. And then, we covered as many parts of the park as we could. One thing we did do in this film also is we pay tribute to the nine families that Billy recruited and that Andy called the best and the brightest of Atlanta. These were the people called in Olympic circles known as the Atlanta Nine. And this is, Bobby Reardon, Cindy Fowler, Ginger Watkins, Horace Sibley, Charlie Battle. I could name them all. But the fact of the matter is that in Billy's Plaza, in the plaza where Billy's statue is, there's actually a tribute to the nine families who put their lives on hold to pursue this improbable dream for the city. And so these are men and women who really stepped up. And that's part of what Andy said was his motivation in bidding for the games. As Shirley Franklin describes it, as he came to her and she said, in the film, there's this little bit of controversy where Shirley says, "This is folly. We can't do this, Andy. You've only got 2 years left in your administration. We've got a lot to accomplish." And he says, "Well, I'm going to do it, Shirley, because I think we can win. But even if we don't, it's going to bring people from all over the city together." And he said, "I think that's good for Atlanta."
Yeah.
And it brought these families together. And it's a great moment.
Yeah.
It's a great moment. Shirley is amazing.
Shirley is amazing. I'm a huge fan. Shout out Mayor Franklin all day, every day. But one other thing that Andy said that I loved was I pride myself on being on really great teams. Mm. And this was a great team. Mm. You know, Andy is one of the greatest leaders that we've seen, who's, you know, a living legend. So just the fact that we could capture his story in this film is so wonderful. But you know, he's also not going to toot his own horn, really.
He deflects all credit.
It was the team. And you know, that's him referring to the Atlanta Nine. But, you know, you talked about how the story started with, Billy Payne. One thing I love that we did is also tell their stories before any of this. So I learned so much about Ambassador Andrew Young through working on this. I learned so much about Billy Payne. And I think when we were at the beginning of the process of making this film and George was writing their bios, I really didn't see it. I was like, how are we gonna get the audience to connect with Billy's story as much as they do Andy's? Because, you know, everyone knows Andy, right? But this was an opportunity to share who Billy Payne is as well. And once we got all of the archival footage together and the music and, you know, hearing from each of their children telling their stories and them telling their own stories, I mean, it's an incredible part of the film. And it really kicks off how the rest of the film is told, I think.
I agree. I think that their bios are amazing. And such contrast. Here's a white guy born in the segregated South playing on a football team at the University of Georgia before African-Americans were allowed in. And then here's a guy who was, in fact, Martin Luther King's Jr.'s right-hand man in the civil rights movement. And as one of our interviews says, he said, on paper, these two guys will never get along. They're complete opposites. But they came together, and their friendship is enduring. I mean, they are still best friends. It really is amazing. So, and then I think one of the great things that another one of our other producers, Rohan Backfish, did was introduce us to Dallas Austin. We wanted to have a soundtrack that used two forms of American indigenous music, which is jazz and hip hop, and so we got Dallas Austin to come in for a meeting, and we had an idea to do a theme song on the City Too Busy to Hate, the old theme of Atlanta, and Dallas produced an incredible song for us. He really did. And then we got a guy named Joe Alterman, who's an incredible Atlanta-based jazz pianist, to come in, and he worked with Dallas, so we have these incredible music transitions from hip-hop to jazz and back again, and it really helps to tie the whole story together in a beautiful way. Yeah. And you shot Dallas recording in his studio.
Yeah, I mean, they, you know, Joe Alderman and Dallas Austin together knocked it out of the park. I did get to film some BTS of Dallas Austin working with, is his name Champ?
Champ with two P's.
Yeah, Champ with two P's. City Too Busy to Hate. Hey, City Too Busy to Hate. I wasn't on that track, as you can see. But yeah, I think that it's really hard to know how good a film is without music. So we had watched rough cut after rough cut, and we're like, I think it's good. But then when you hear the soundtrack, it's like, oh, we made something.
And the sound effects.
Very special. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And the sound effects. Yeah.
Which is SmartPost, right?
SmartPost, yeah. Mm-hmm. Dave Wilson put together the sound effects for this thing, and he did a brilliant job. And the music mix is excellent, thanks to Dallas and Joe. And here's a little taste of it.
Hey. Oh. So, Dallas.
So anyway,
yeah,
Dallas Austin
is going to release it on, you said, over 200 platforms worldwide?
200 platforms worldwide. If you're in Korea, you can get it. If you're in Thailand, you can get it. If you're in Vietnam, if you're in South Africa, you'll be able to get it anywhere.
Incredible. And so the hope is that the song goes viral, and all over the world, everyone's singing about Atlanta being the city too busy to hate.
Beautiful. And you said that'll be next week.
That'll be Wednesday the 9th. I think Wednesday the 9th we'll release it, yeah.
Okay, beautiful, beautiful. And this should be coming out on Monday.
And
so
then the
timing.
Film premiere is at the Rialto Center for the Arts on Saturday, April 26th at 6:30 p.m. The show will go on. There'll be a Q&A after the film with Billy and Andy, which will be a great
awesome.
Wrap-up. And I think that's about it, right?
Yeah, come out, support the film, support your Atlanta filmmakers. We made this for y'all.
Oh, I know. And if you want to buy tickets, you can go on the Atlanta Film Festival site and look up the games in black and white, and you can buy tickets to the premiere. There's probably about 400 tickets left, I think, in the 800-seat theater. So thanks very much, Austin. This was fun to do. Yeah.
Beautiful. Absolutely. And we'll link that in the description for the podcast as well. I appreciate y'all's time and exciting time coming up in the next few weeks. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Really looking forward to this film. Thanks again to George and Alana for taking some time to chat about it. Sounds like it'll be a great story and a beautiful illustration of one of the great, if not the greatest, times to be in Atlanta. And of course, like George said, we're still seeing the fruits of that labor and all that went into the Olympics here in Atlanta paying off and being somewhat of a launching point for what our area of downtown is today. For tickets for the premiere, you can check out the Atlanta Film Festival's website at atlantafilmfestival.com. Again, atlantafilmfestival.com. I'll also link that in the description. And that's Saturday, April 26th at the Rialto Center for the Arts. Go check it out. This has been a production of Georgia World Congress Center Authority. Thanks for joining us today, and until next time, we'll see you later.